live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary from Mike Miller of DePaul University, Del Wright of Valparaiso University, and Mark Witte from Northwestern University. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the new Museum of Broadcast Communications on State Street, that great street in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. Well, tonight we will be talking about the economic woes of this country and also the problems that the Standard & Poor's reduction in our credit rating means not only for you but for the nation, and how the world is responding to it right now and how the markets around the world will respond to it when they open up tomorrow morning. But I would be remiss if I did not say at the very beginning of this program that although the economic woes of this country are very difficult at this moment, the nation as a whole has a heavy heart tonight with the loss of 30 U.S. servicemen, many of them members of the U.S. SEAL unit, who died trying to save members of the Army Rangers in Afghanistan. The death is the worst accident or worst death toll in well over 4 years in Afghanistan, and it involves also seven Afghan military leaders as well. And so America's heart is heavy tonight. And again, before you go to bed, please say your prayer for the members of the families of those who gave their life in support of the United States and its foreign policy. We now move to the principal topic of this evening. As I mentioned, you all know by now Standard & Poor's, one of the leading credit agencies in the world. They reduced the AAA rating of the United States to AA. That's the first time in history that has happened. And we'll talk more about some of the specific points that they made in their announcement, but I want to get reaction. We've got a lot of experts around the table this evening. Mike Miller, you teach economics at DePaul University. Your reaction to the downgrading?
The downgrade has three aspects to it from my perspective. One is political, and there are, of course, accusations being thrown in all directions, and I think that both parties and leaders are being affected by this. The second is reputation. The United States, for the first time, has been downgraded. Now, I think it bruises our ego and also takes us down a peg, maybe in the eyes of the rest of the world. And the third piece is the economic, and I find that one the most preposterous. I just don't understand why S&P did this. That I can't believe for a second that we're less likely than we were 3 weeks ago to not pay you back if you invest in the U.S. I think it's based upon crazy ideas regarding whether or not they can make forecasts that far into the future. And I'm not sure I exactly trust S&P.
Mark Witte from Northwestern University, your response.
Well, I don't think it's a big deal in terms of, you know, what's going to affect the markets this coming week, but which is always a dangerous thing to say. But I do think that the U.S. seems like a less reliable place, that you know our ability to make payments is subject to this debt ceiling machinery that can really screw things up.
Mm-hmm. And also joining us this evening, Del Wright from Valparaiso University, your response.
Well, I think it's structurally a problem for the government long-term if they can't get their act together politically. I think it could have long-term downside effects for the U.S. economy.
In the overview, this is what Standard & Poor's had to say. The downgrade reflects our opinion that the fiscal consolidation plan that Congress and the administration recently agreed to falls short of what, in our view, would be necessary to stabilize the government's medium-term debt dynamics. They go on to say, the downgrade reflects our view that the effectiveness, stability, and predictability of American policymaking and political institutions have weakened at a time of ongoing fiscal and economic challenges to a degree more than we envisioned when we assigned a negative outlook to the rating on April 18th of 2011. When I first heard this news, I said, the Tea Party people must be dancing in the streets. Is this not similar? At least some of the rhetoric that was used in the overview and the rationale, isn't it right out of the Tea Party's playbook, rhetorical playbook, in your view, Dell?
Well, yes and no. I think more what Standard & Poor's did is gave an assessment of the political situation in the U.S., not its long-term structural economic health, but how the politics has gotten to the point where we're in danger of not being able to do anything.
Do you see that the same way?
I mean, I think it is really more of a political problem than an economic problem.
But again, a political problem, and how will voters react to this? Will they say a pox on both the Republican and Democratic House leaders? And will they basically say the Tea Party was right? The Tea Party rhetoric is right. Maybe more people will follow the Tea Party. Is that a fear of yours?
Well, to take it on a slightly different tangent, the hope when they pushed up the debt limit was that it would push this beyond the fall 2012 election. But if we dip into a second recession, that's going to slow tax revenues, and we could actually hit the revenue or the debt limit before the election, and boy, would that be interesting.
You're right, yeah, Mike. Every one of the things that listed there are problems in the budgeting over the next 20 or 30 years that we all recognize, whether Tea Party or Democrat or whatever. It's just our willingness to – where are we going to do it? Are we going to raise revenue or are we going to cut benefits or whatever? We have to have that discussion, and I'm positive we will have that discussion. My only problem is that I always think of S&P in terms of they're to tell me what is the probability that somebody to whom I lend money is not going to pay me back. And it's almost like they decided they're going to be the arbiter of what is good government and what is not, without making any mention of the probability of payback. And I think in terms of my gut reaction, that's the thing that I don't like about this whole situation.
Is it likely, Standard & Poor's is one of three major agencies, is it likely that the other two are going to follow suit? I guess they've already sent some signal that they're not. What does that mean when there's a split decision on that field, in your view? How does the world react to that, Mark?
Well, there are places that are limited by law or by rules to only hold AAA securities. But usually what they do is they go with the median. So, you know, if there's three and two rated AAA and one does not, then that's AAA in their eyes. And so I think S&P sort of knew that this was a free shot, that they could make this vote or they could make this signal without, you know, it really creating any –
Some have suggested that it's a PR stunt. Do you buy that? Are you that cynical?
I am that cynical. I mean, I think that – I mean, they wanted to downgrade, and I think what they released was their pretext. And then Geithner said, well, wait a minute, use the wrong baseline.
Yeah.
That, you know, you use the CBO baseline that brought in, you know, these cuts already into it, and so you're expecting a bigger cutoff that – and when he pointed out to them, they're like, well, that's fine. We're still downgrading.
Yeah, $2 trillion error. They made a $2 trillion error, and somehow, after they put the $2 trillion back in, it didn't change their overall outcome. That's preposterous. Again, certain things, they just don't pass the old smell test. That something is really screwy here, and I have some of the same reaction that Mark does.
I want to talk more about who Standard & Poor's, who are they, and why do they have so much power, and we'll do that when we come back. 1-800-723-8289 if you'd like to weigh in on the economic woes of the country and how they might be resolved. 1-800-723-8289 from coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce Dumont, live from Chicago. From Fresno, California to Youngstown, Ohio, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. And a reminder for everybody listening to us on WKBN in Youngstown, the Big 57 AM, covering all of northeastern Ohio and lots of West Virginia and western Pennsylvania. We will be doing the broadcast live from WKBN next Sunday night. We'll be talking about all of the issues as they relate to the state of Ohio and some of the things that Governor Kasich and the battles that are going on in the Buckeye State and how they affect not only what's happening there, but the signals they are sending to political leaders and organizers all over the United States. So again, you want to take the pulse of what's happening in America, you go to Ohio. Nobody wins the presidency without winning Ohio. And so we'll be heading to Mahoning County next week live from WKBN in Youngstown, Ohio. We're talking about the Standard & Poor's, a downgrading of the U.S. Credit rating this evening from AAA to AA. We're getting reaction from our guests, but also to go back to some of the things that Standard & Poor's had to say as part of the rationale for what they did. And they said this: The political brinksmanship of recent months highlights what we see as America's governance and policymaking becoming less stable, less effective, and less predictable than what we previously believed. They go on to say, Republicans and Democrats have only been able to agree to relatively modest savings on discretionary spending while delegating to the select committee decisions on more comprehensive measures. In our opinion, is that elected officials remain wary of tackling the structural issues required to effectively address the rising U.S. public debt burden. When you get into criticism of the governance, when one looks at the core of criticizing the government and Congress over the last several months or several years, are they criticizing democracy?
Yeah, in some sense they are, because it's very messy, especially when people have different opinions and they come to those opinions after lots of thought and reading and reflection. We can disagree, and sometimes it's very messy to try to come up with a compromise or a solution that everybody can deal with, and that's just the nature of it. I'll take it any time over some dictator telling me exactly what to do.
Your reaction?
I think this is the first step in the death of the Tea Party, because what I think the American people and what the political professional class will do with this is say the Democrats and the Republicans were ready to come to an agreement. The Tea Party stepped in and said, we're going to hold the country hostage. And that's what happened. They held the country hostage and they said, you will not raise any revenue.
Why do you think that the country is being held hostage by them? Haven't the rest of the people been held hostage by the establishment Republicans and Democrats? Mm-hmm. They're the ones that ran up the deficit.
Sure.
They're the ones that chose to say one thing before the election and do something differently after the election. It was only when the Tea Party organized people, angry people all over the United States, that say enough is enough. And they went to Washington, and like a lot of politicians, they went to Washington and decided to stand by what sent them there, their principles, or the pressure from the folks back home.
Right, they did, but they ignored the systematic problems with the government. Granted, you can stand outside and throw rocks and say, this is terrible, you can do X, Y, and Z, but until you actually get in there and you have to make law, it's different. And when they got
they did get in there. They didn't throw rocks.
No.
They got in.
But what did they run on exactly? I mean, they ran on not taking away your Medicare. And then they're pushing for cuts in Medicare. So that seems a little inconsistent to me.
Yeah, but use the word hostage takers, how come Jan Schakowsky, who is, I guess, a socialist, I think she might be proud of that statement, she voted against the final package. Somehow she's a woman of principle, but the Tea Party are somehow hostage takers. These are just people with two fundamentally different views, and we fight it out. Mm-hmm. And then you go have a beer together after it's all over. And I just think that's the way the system's got to work.
Well, I think a difference is that I think she would have voted for it if failing to vote for it would have led to default.
Yeah, so she got a free ride. But the whole point is she's being described
I'm saying that I don't think a lot of the Tea Party people would have. I think they would have been fine to go with default.
Well, that's what they were sent there by a lot of people. I'm not a Tea Party member. I'm a proud Republican, but I'm not a Tea Partier. And I just think that people can have these different and strong differences of opinion. And as long as you're willing to talk to me and we can try to work things out, that's
great. Do you agree with Dell that this may be the beginning of the end of the Tea Party?
Because I have no idea.
What did your gut? When you read the first or heard the first story about this, did it pop into your mind that maybe the Tea Party would get some credibility out of this story? To the average person, not necessarily to the, you know, in the halls of Ivy where you walk, nothing wrong with those halls of Ivy, but again,
in Schakowsky's district,
different people respond to different things.
Well, I mean, I think it's true that Boehner does not control his caucus, that he could not pass a bill, Strickland Republican votes, that would have had revenue in it, and that he had to end up passing this with a lot of votes from the Democrats, and he could have gotten more if he'd have needed them. If your Republicans had voted for it.
But of course, Mr. Obama said he would veto anything that was short term. He wasn't exactly Mr. Bend Over Backwards to Compromise. He set up a wall. Mm-hmm. Nobody's calling him a hostage taker. I just don't like the incendiary that somehow when I have a difference of opinion, I'm an evil person. No, I just have difference of opinion. And that's what I don't like that.
Del?
But the problem is they were willing to send the country into a period where we would not be paying our debts. That's holding the country hostage and saying, look, unless you do exactly as we say, and they pretty much got their way because the president effectively caved.
No.
But again, that's a political equation. You have a mashing of differing opinions. Somebody's got a firm back and stands for what they believe in, and others cave.
The president
caved on this, right?
He did.
He caved to his constituents. His constituents who sent him to Washington because he was going to represent change, he caved to them.
He certainly did. And what you're seeing in the polls...
That's not admirable, is it?
But what you're seeing in the polls now is the people who have kind of, the polls that have come out so far have said they blame more than any other group the Tea Party for this. And they said the president's going to spin this as, I caved to protect the country. And the Tea Party is going to bear the brunt of this in 2 years. They are. We'll see.
Well, we'll see. Let's go to calls right now. Let's go to Jeanette, listening to us on WLS Radio in Chicago, our flagship station. Go ahead.
Yes, I would like to thank you for taking my call. But all, with all due respect, Mr. Dumont, what do the Tea Party have to be celebrating about? Your comment that you made, which was very irresponsible. The Tea Party is bringing our nation down. They have no credibility. They let the last president give away all those tax breaks while we were in two wars, and they sit back and they did nothing. We didn't see not one sign in the street. And now, since we have a president who is trying to work to bring this nation together, then they're going to come out against him, and look where we are now. And you're going to sit up there and say they should be celebrating?
With all due respect,
I don't think so. And I agree with the guy, I don't know his name, but they will be voted out of office. I guarantee you.
Well, we will find out. I mean, that's why we have a democracy. But again, in a democracy, you have differences of opinions. And in some of the rhetoric that, at least in the rationale that Moody's was talking about, it sounded like they didn't think that was a good idea, which was the question I asked of Professor Miller.
A couple other things you want to keep in mind. I know that we do have to talk about and negotiate spending and taxes and deductions and so forth. But keep in mind that the Tea Party did not exist in 2007, if I remember correctly. It was something that came after that. And further, in 2007, right before everything went bad, under the current tax benefits that you're talking about, the deficit was 1.8% of GDP. Unemployment was 4.6%. So those tax rates are not the issue. It's the fact that so many people are unemployed. See, the one thing we're missing, focusing so much on this, which of course is an important factor, we're missing the fact that GDP was revised and the numbers are absolutely pathetic. We haven't even passed the previous peak in GDP when we first went into the recession. On top of that, the unemployment rate is only now inching down. We need economic growth in
many
of these
problems.
But
you saw some positive thing in the numbers that came out last week.
Yeah, one thing that was very positive to me was that the number of new payroll jobs in the private sector was 154,000. The fact that it was only 100 and some thousand was because there were 37,000 fewer government jobs. But the true engine of economic growth, the true engine of jobs at last, is the private sector. That was a good number. The rest of it was pretty bad, but that was a good number.
Now, you said something. 37,000 fewer government jobs. Is that a good? Does the Tea Party get credit for that?
Well, it would certainly be bad credit.
The government's getting smaller.
Yeah, over the last 2 years, we were down 500,000 government jobs.
Yeah.
And I mean, you talk about private sector job growth, but that's barely keeping pace with population growth.
It's better, but it was nothing before. I'm looking for some kind of bright, because what we need is economic growth. Can imagine how many dollars worth of revenue will come in and all of a sudden change that picture about the size of the deficit. Mm-hmm. Because what S&P is focusing on is the fact that GDP and the debt deficit are growing faster than the economy's growing. Mm-hmm. So if you go into debt faster than you are earning new money, that's where the problem arises. If we could grow faster, many of these problems would simply disappear.
When did credit rating agencies become part of the government process? Are they as old as the nation?
I believe they've been around since the 30s. That's what I've heard.
I mean, credit rating agencies have gone back. I mean, like, I think of Oh, the famous English tea house.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. But they go back a long way. Just like you said, the last time you gentlemen were giving your course on our broadcast, you talked about the deficits. The deficits go back to the Revolutionary War.
Yes.
On that note, we do have to pause. 1-800-723-8289. What's the name?
Lloyds.
1-800-723-8289 from coast to coast and border to border. Tonight, we're talking about the drop in the U.S. credit rating, what it means. And again, when we come back, we're going to look ahead to what the markets around the world, what they might be doing tomorrow, and what you should do with your money. Back shortly. From Sioux City, Iowa to La Crosse, Wisconsin, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us. Mark Witte is with us this evening. He is director of the Undergraduate Studies Program in the Department of Economics at Northwestern University, once upon a time a research associate at the Federal Reserve. Mike Miller also joins us, a native of Pittsburgh. He is an associate professor of economics at DePaul University. And Del Wright joins us this evening. He is an assistant professor of law at Valparaiso University, born and bred in Washington, D.C., and also a graduate master's degree in public policy at the Harvard School, Kennedy School at Harvard University, University of Chicago Law School graduate. Let's go back to calls. Let's go to WIZM. Let's go to La Crosse, Wisconsin. Jim is listening to us tonight in Wisconsin. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, gentlemen. Hey, I just came off a 25-year career in credit, and I got to tell you that this downgrade should have occurred a long time ago. America does not cash flow. When you don't cash flow, you're going to pay the price relative to your credit score or your credit status. Also,
Jim, what does that mean? Explain that in lay terms. What does that mean?
It doesn't generate enough cash to pay its operating expenses without borrowing that. It's okay to borrow funds if you're going to service term debt. And I suspect that some of the monthly payments are term debt, but the vast majority of it is operating expenses and Medicare expenses and Medicaid and all the entitlement funds. That's all operating. That's not term debt. With the new bridges is term debt, but and then again, just a couple other thoughts, and I'll get off the line quick. Thank you for taking the chance. You probably need to reiterate to folks that the Tea Party was not even in play when Obama was elected president. It just came around 2010 elections, and the Tea Party is an acronym for Taxed Enough Already. Thank God these people were elected. And to use the word, as you, one of you pointed out, hostage, is totally irresponsible to use that kind of phraseology. These were congressmen or congresspeople that were elected based on promises they made, and they thank God for something entirely new, congresspeople that were elected and carried out what they promised to do. So just some thoughts for you. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, governments don't run quite like private corporations do. I get his point, but if you even take something like I'm not an accountant, but it's called generally accepted accounting practices. The government doesn't do the same kinds of things. We don't. The government doesn't have capital accounting in the same way. We make a $4 billion submarine and we expense it all out right away, instantaneously. It's dollars in, dollars out. It's a different picture. And the creditworthiness, the two big things different of a government compared to a corporation in assessing their ability to pay is, one, the government can tax and do so by force, and secondly, this government, the federal government, can print money. When you add those two things together, it really is a different world when you're dealing with a federal government compared to a regular company.
When does Standard & Poor's look at the books the next time? How long will we keep this double A with them?
Well, it's a continuous process. I mean, that they rank sovereign debt all over the world. And you're talking about a criticism of democracy. They don't do that. I mean, I wouldn't say it's criticism of democracy. They rate all sorts of countries, and they're just looking at sort of the functionality of the government and is the government collecting enough to pay its expenses and service its debt. And any new information they get, they work that into their
ranking. But again, are they not? I mean, in a parliamentary government, mm-hmm. you know, the government can be all shifted at once in and out. I mean, they may like that idea. That's not the way we do it here. We do it differently here.
Yeah. I mean, that's a democracy as well.
Well, that's what I'm saying. But
you change to another government, and that may bring down your credit rating. That's actually one thing that comes up in campaigns.
Does it happen a lot?
Oh yeah.
But I think Jim's point was a valid one in that we do have to talk about raising revenues. And, you know, the talk so far has been about raising taxes, but there's a much simpler solution. It's simplifying the tax code.
Oh, yeah.
You can actually lower rates and raise more revenue, but there are a lot of sacred cows out there that people are going to have to make some very uncomfortable choices about, such as home mortgage deduction. I mean, if you have a $2 million house, should you get to be able to deduct all your interest expense? That is basically a gift to the rich, and the poor are paying for it. So there are a lot of things we can do to raise revenues without raising taxes.
Now, you're going for your master's degree in taxation from New York University as we speak.
Yes.
You're a professor one place, you're a student in another place.
Yeah.
So, but as you look at this, but again, tax law is your area of expertise. Are we undertaxed in this country, in your view?
Yes, we are.
Compared to who?
Well, compared to all the countries that U.S. corporations have moved to so that they can shift work over there and pay less taxes. The problem is
European countries, most European countries.
A lot of European countries. Isle of Skye, Ireland.
Are you saying we're undertaxed compared to them?
Well, I'm saying, no, I guess technically we're overtaxed.
Oh,
but
yes.
It's a structural problem in how we're taxed. Yeah. It's really not a rate issue. It's a structural problem in how we're taxed. We need to lower our rates to get jobs back over here. I mean, there's no reason that Google should be in Ireland. It's a U.S. company, but they aren't because the way our tax system is set up, it encourages U.S. companies to move abroad, taking jobs and tax revenues with them.
Is what needs to be done in a political climate, mm-hmm, when it's very difficult to get anything of a monumental nature done? I think we talked about this briefly the last time you were on the show. How realistic is it that we could have significant change in our tax system, the tax structure?
It happened once in my lifetime, and that was under Ronald Reagan. I think that was a fundamental change. I think it could happen again in terms of maybe trying to get more taxpayers and making it simpler. I think that would be a real big change. The tax system also tries to change people's behavior. I always like what is the most efficient way to raise the money? To me, I don't like using the tax system as a weapon, either to carry out some kind of attack upon smokers, of which I'm not. I don't get that, and so forth.
Before we take our next call, and we'll do it in just a second, what should the person who was thinking of doing some investing, what should they do right now, Mark?
Oh, good question.
I'm listening, Mark.
isn't the old adage, buy low? So it's going to be low tomorrow, right?
Diversify your portfolio, yeah. I don't know. We're in a strange situation where stock, equities are, looking at price compared to earnings, they're actually not cheap at all. And, bonds are really high priced. I am not sure.
Does anybody at this table expect interest rates to be going up as a result of this?
See, normally when you get downgraded, that means you have to pay more to the market because the probability of default is higher. There's one difference, though, when you're dealing with something like the U.S. government. The value or the price that is paid for the bonds is determined in an auction. It's all going to depend upon when that auction occurs, who is willing to give the government money and at what price. So it could be that the markets will completely ignore this downgrade and say, I still want those government securities because I believe they're the safest thing in the world.
Well, so, and I quite agree with that. I think of debt rating as like a restaurant review. If it's a restaurant nobody's heard of and it gets a bad review, that's terrible for, mm-hmm, the restaurant. But it's a restaurant that everybody knows and gets a bad review, people just shrug it off.
Yeah.
Everybody knows all about U.S. debt.
That's
and this
right.
review had no information.
I don't
content.
Foresee it.
In a week that follows the Standard & Poor's decision that came down late in the week, mm-hmm, and you had the reaction of the stock market earlier in the, mm-hmm, week, what is likely, in your view, in your crystal ball, Dell, what is likely to happen on the world markets and the stock market tomorrow as you see it?
I don't see the U.S. market being affected too greatly by what happened with S&P. I think there are a lot of other structural factors that go on into what happens, because most people look at the Dow, which is 30 stocks, and think that's the market. And that's not the market. There are thousands or millions of companies out there, And I don't think you can really gauge what's going to happen with the market by one rating agency downgrading the U.S. government.
Yeah, we see that the Middle East is already open because Sunday is their first day of the week, and those markets were down. And I had somebody text me right before the show that the futures for the United States are down 287 points. Now, that would be about 3% on the Dow. So if we take a 3% hit, we've had 3% hits before. That's not the end of the world. And I think people are going to begin to realize this is S&P. This is the company that didn't see Enron. They didn't see Fannie and Freddie. They didn't see all the problems regarding the mortgage-backed securities. So is this a company compared to, say, Moody's or Fitch that we're gonna hang our hat on and we're going to make all of our decisions based upon this company's evaluation of the United States? I don't get it.
And that might be why they did it. They are the company that made those bad calls. Maybe they want to get out there and put their name out there and say, hey, we are willing to make a tough call. And maybe this is their chance.
So, again, if people are around the world that are reacting, what I'm hearing you say is they probably will not overreact because they probably know the same thing you know, that Standard & Poor's has been on a losing streak.
Yeah. And there's always some people
who agree with that.
Yeah.
Mark? I think that's fair. But I also think that to the extent people are reacting things, they're not going to be reacting to this, that there's much bigger news, and that's the troubles of Europe.
Let's go to Corpus – actually, let's go to Corpus Christi, Texas. Listening to us on XM Radio. Go ahead.
How you doing, Bruce? And good morning. The reason I say that is you're the beginning of my political week. So always enjoy it. But my comment is that this has nothing to do with our political, or I should say our monetary cap in debt. This has altogether to do with our debt and our baseline budget, which adds 8% every year, and as I understand it, will add another $9 trillion
Mike, let me interrupt you for a moment. I'm going to put you on hold. I'm going to let you continue your comment, and we're going to pause for a few minutes of commercials, and we'll be back, and we will hear more from Mike in Corpus Christi listening to us on XM Radio tonight, along with the great talk terrestrial radio stations in America, Sirius on XM Radio every Sunday night, coast to coast, border to border. From Leavenworth, Kansas to Elkton, Ohio, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Let's go back to Corpus Christi, Texas, where Mike was listening to us on XM. We had to break for a spot, sell a little product, help the economy along, at least our personal economy. So back to you, Mike. You're on the air.
Thank God for corporatism. Anyway, I think our problem is the fact that anybody who is in the business of lending money, much less overseeing it, is more than aware of what baseline budgeting and our current 8% addition to every budget every year is going to do to what our debt is going to be within the 10 years that we have forecast our budget for. As I understand it, that's going to be another $9 trillion on top of our current $14 trillion debt, and that's unsustainable. No wonder they downgraded us. If I was running that corporation, I would have downgraded this long before now.
Mike, I'm going to read you a line, and your this idea of these baseline budgets. I understand your point that one thing that macroeconomists, we don't do always that well is forecast turning points in the business cycle, when it's going to turn into a recession or when the recession is going to end. But forecasting for budgets is, at least for the government, is atrocious. And this is, here's the line. Under OMB's new baseline projection, the public debt would be eliminated in fiscal year 2009. And that was written in the year 2000. We were debating in college, in our money and banking classes, what's the Fed going to do when there's no more treasuries to use for monetary policy? These projections out to 2021, it's fiction. You might as well be using tarot cards because there's just no way we can know what's going to happen.
Thanks for your call.
I agree 100%.
All right, we're going to go to Jeff listening to us in Fresno, California, on KMJFM, our new affiliate in the Golden State. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Great show. I just think that, you know, to me, we're kind of in a death spiral in this country, and I don't think anybody realizes. I mean, at some point in time, we're going to have to balance the budget, and I understand what, you know, you said about projections, but I mean, what my question would be to everybody is 25 trillion, I mean, at what point are we going to have to say enough is enough? And so I just don't understand that nobody gets the fact that we're not going to pay back 14 trillion. We're not going to pay that back. Even if we have a half a trillion budget surplus for 8 years, that's $4 trillion. That's if we balance the budget. We're not going to pay this money back. My question is, what's the limit? I mean, when
Jeff,
is it going to end?
Stay on the line. I'm going to flip your question a little bit, but I want you to stay on the line. I'm going to give you the last word, and I'm going to ask Mark, why do we have to balance the budget? Why do we have to do it?
We don't have to balance the budget.
Okay.
I mean, going back to the point you made about after World War II, we had the debt to GDP ratio.
Then explain to Jeff, mm-hmm. to me, and to people listening who believe that a balanced budget amendment is a good idea. Mm-hmm. It forces government to live within its means. Why is that not a good idea?
It's a terrible idea.
Why?
It's a bad idea even for people. You can never buy a house. You can never go to college unless you paid cash out of pocket. You want to borrow for things. And one thing you want to borrow for is to get through tough times like this bad recession. But you talk about balancing the budget or paying it back. Do you know who we owe the money to? I mean, we owe some to the Chinese, we owe some to other people, but most part, we owe it to Americans. That, you know, most of the U.S. debt is owned by American institutions and Americans themselves. And so to pay it back, we'd have to basically tax Americans to pay Americans. And that's not really productive, particularly since people want to own this debt. It's a great asset to hold.
Jeff, back to you. Your response to Professor Witte.
Well, you know, that doesn't make any sense to me. I own my house outright, and I own my car outright, and I don't have any credit card debt. But my question
You bought your house for cash?
With cash.
Boy, you are in a very small minority.
I know.
Jeez.
God bless you, by the way.
Yeah, good for you.
Okay, but my question, back to my question, how much until we can't borrow anymore?
When the market, when there's a failed auction, when the federal government goes before the people of the world and says, we want to borrow money and nobody shows up.
You look at the 30-year rates and it's nowhere on the horizon.
No,
Jeff, thanks very much for your call. My next question to you is, you've all alluded at some point this evening to just printing more money. When does the government print more money, Mike?
They're doing it during QE2 and so forth, and QE1. That was printing of money. What they were doing was providing a market for U.S. government treasuries to keep long-term interest rates down. And for those of you on the right, that was an idea also endorsed by Milton Friedman, that once interest rates are at zero in the short run, the only way to get long-run rates down is to go into the market and buy them.
So there is printing
of money can be okay as long as over time it's under control.
So there is a criteria when the economy and the wizards that coordinate this, mm-hmm. who makes the decision to print more money?
It's a combination of the Fed, the Treasury, and more likely the Fed in terms of their decision on how can we use interest rates as a tool to try to influence the economy to grow closer towards its potential.
So there's a very specific and probably convoluted series of things that have to happen that trigger the printing of more money, Mark?
Well, I mean, the Fed can basically do whatever it wants, but I would say a QE2 is not an example of this. The QE2 is just getting us through a liquidity problem.
Sure, it was a liquidity. I agree.
You're thinking about long-term solvency of the government and using, you know, sort of seniorage money creation to cover that. That's a somewhat different thing,
yes,
and it's actually much tougher for the U.S. than most people seem mm-hmm. to think.
Okay, on that note, our professors will be back for the next course shortly. In hour number one, we have been joined by Mark Witte. He is from Northwestern University. Del Wright is from Valparaiso University. And Mike Miller is from DePaul University. They will all be back. Session number two of Economics 101 on Beyond the Beltway this evening will continue. 1-800-723-8029. Hop on the line. We got a lot of callers on the line. Free course. This is all a free course. Nobody's going to be billed for this. Got another hour coming up. We hope you're with us. 1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont from Chicago. Back shortly. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Mike Miller of DePaul University, Del Wright of Valparaiso University, and Mark Witte of Northwestern University. Our program tonight coming to my home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. 1-800-723-8029 is the telephone number. BTB at museum.tv is our website. I'm going back many, many years with an old email address. And www.beyondthebeltway.com if you'd like to join us on the internet. And the broadcast is saved for many, many, many months. And if you miss us on a Sunday night and want to catch us on the internet, you can do it at our website, beyondthebeltway.com. We continue now with the course that we began recently, talking about what's happening economically in the country. And we've got three great guests who know an awful lot about the subject. We'll take some calls at 1-800-723-8029 in just a moment. But I want to ask a little bit about how the world is reacting to the downgrade of the U.S. Credit by Standard & Poor's. And a question, sort of a broad question, why should we as Americans care how the Europeans respond to our fiscal situation? Mark Miller.
Well, we have a situation where we borrow money from all over the world, and therefore they really do care what happens in the U.S. because they hold our paper. We don't hold as much nearly of theirs. So with Greece in trouble and so forth, very little of that is held in the U.S., and our banks are not in trouble because of Greece and Portugal and Spain. But what happens is that the Europeans and the Middle East and Asia and so forth, they buy U.S. securities. So if they think for a second that there's some problem, that they may then begin to take a second look before they buy any more. Now, we've never feared that they're going to sell what they have because a mass selling of it would so destroy the value of the dollar that they would be selling assets which become worthless. But the question becomes, what happens if they're not there willing to lend us new money? So it does matter to us what they think in terms of coming to the table with some money.
If we were to look at Europe today, Mark Witte from Northwestern University, where is the strength in Europe and where are the economic basket cases?
Yeah, well, the strength is Germany, really in France, but the extent that they're tied in with the basket cases, I mean, certainly Greece is the most famous, Ireland, Portugal, but, you know, now Spain and Italy. Italy, you know, the 10th largest economy in the world, is really in trouble. And you're talking about the debt downgrade here. Europe would love to have our problems. I mean, they're in so much worse trouble. And you think
why?
About, like,
what is it that they've done that puts them in more trouble than us?
One, they don't control their own monetary policy. That here we can have a loose monetary policy to try to get our economy moving and, you know, get GDP growing. There, I mean, Germany and France basically set the monetary policy and are keeping it, you know, at a very strict level to keep inflation down. But, you know, inflation's fine. They should, you know, be willing to, you know, have a little more inflation, get a little more growth. If they had more growth, they'd have a lot more tax revenue in Italy and Spain would be fine. But, you know, with tight monetary policy, it's a slow economy and huge unemployment rates, you know, 20%, you know, plus in Spain, approaching that in Italy, and it's really wrecking those economies, and that's what's driving their debt problems. You think about, like, our debt troubles. U.S. debt looks great compared to any other debt in the world. I mean, what else would you buy if you're looking for sovereign debt? I mean, Japanese debt, English debt,
no.
Swiss? I mean, they're all going to get rolled under by European troubles.
But collectively, if we're looking at Europe, realizing that every country is different insofar as how they operate, mm-hmm. At least from a governmental standpoint, are the issues of, we mentioned unemployment is very mm-hmm. high in a lot of European countries, but what about overspending? What about taxation? How does that measure against the United States?
Well, they are far left of us pretty much across the board. Their social safety net is a lot broader. It carries more people. There are a lot more people on unemployment. You don't really have to work in a lot of European countries. They will give you a check just to exist. That doesn't happen here. If you look at our spectrum from left to right, they would say we're way right. They would say almost across Europe, they'd say the United States is far right. So it's a different ball game for us.
Oh, but I had to object on two things. One, that's sort of Europe of 20 years ago. That you look at, you know, sort of labor force participation rates of, you know, adults, that's really pretty much the same over Northern Europe as it is with the U.S. The other is that they've got a more generous welfare state, but they've got a much tougher tax system, and they're much more consumption-based. And so you take those two together, and it's not that we're – I mean, we've got a much friendlier tax system. Our tax system is much more progressive, and then our welfare system is much cheaper. But, you know, you have to think about those two things together.
But there's one aspect that we have to recognize as well is that I don't want to call it the welfare state because I don't believe we have a welfare state in the U.S., but in Europe and in the United States, we're facing as well a demographic problem. All these programs to take care of the old and so forth and take care of those who can't take care of themselves, that makes sense if your population is growing and you can spread this tax around a lot of people. Europe before us is going into a situation where their populations are beginning to decline. Luckily, we can learn from what they have to go through in terms of figuring out what we can do. But our population is barely at replacement as well. We're facing a demographic crisis, which is now feeding into the economic crisis. Social Security and Medicare would not nearly be as much of a problem if 18, 20, 30, and 40 years ago we had three kids instead of just one.
Since they introduced the euro, which is now, what, 12, 15 years ago?
It's about right. 1999,
yeah,
and it became
12.
Yeah, about 12. Yeah.
How has the collective strength or fiscal stability of Europe been affected by the shift to the euro? The euro being a singular currency that is used in all of the European countries, as opposed to a particular currency in a particular country.
Except Great Britain.
Except Great Britain.
And Switzerland. And some others.
A few exceptions.
So there's this theory called convergence, that poor countries should grow faster than rich countries. So they can bring in more capital per worker, and that brings them up. They can sort of copy the methods of, you know, richer countries and sort of catch up quickly. And so the thought was you bring everybody under a monetary framework. I mean, there have been a lot of trouble with high inflation in different parts of Europe. So you sort of bring everybody under sort of one framework like that, you unify, and you bring up these poor parts of Europe to be, you know, basically like Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And that would justify a lot of investment in these places. And so that was the theory. And in practice, yeah, we poured all this investment in. We pushed up wages and prices, but they were still Greece. They were still Portugal. And so, you know, it was a lot of just misinvestment. I mean, sort of the
sure.
Austrians would be happy on that
yeah.
one. And then one monetary policy to rule them all, and that's a mistake. I mean, Milton Friedman would just pull his hair out if he
of
had
course.
Any.
Yeah, because it's different. We're 50 states all part of the same country, and nationalism does matter to us. We're all Americans, but they're not all – I mean, the Germans are not all Europeans, and the French and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And the big thing was there were some problems in the earlier part of the decade that they thought, look, we got through these. The euro is really – it's fine. It can withstand anything until now. And what you're seeing with Greece, for example, is when Greece got into trouble, the first thing they normally would have done was print a whole bunch of drachma, and then that would lower the value, and everything would be really cheap, and we would go there and visit and buy their products. And well, they can't do that because they borrowed in euros, but they don't print euros.
Also, nobody would have lent to Greece if there was no drachma.
And that's why the European Central Bank now is buying up these bonds, because people are saying, you know, I'm not about to lend money to these countries. And these countries are saying, I can't stand this very high interest rate I'm being charged. So the European Central Bank has become the borrower of last resort.
We've got a break right now. 1-800-723-8229. More calls when we come back. From Atlanta, Georgia to Marion, Illinois, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Let's head to Marion, where Larry is listening to us on WTIM. Larry, nice to have you with us tonight.
Thank you very much. Hey, a couple of comments and questions for your guests, and I'll lean back on the radio and listen to the comments. Number one, the Tea Party, I don't think, won this deal. They wanted to stop the debt ceiling increase, but we now have a $4 trillion debt ceiling increase. My question for your guest is, this debt ceiling was designed as a cap on government spending to restrain them from irresponsibly spending taxpayer money. It obviously hasn't worked. It's been raised, what, 10 times in the last 10 years. Why don't we just get rid of it? That's question number one. Number two is, Obama seems to be doing everything wrong in relation to democratic principles. He seems to be leaning toward the socialist side. Do any of your guests think that Obama and the Democrats might be trying to economically destroy the country on purpose, or is it just stupidity? All right.
Okay, let's let Mark Witte respond, because I think he's got some opinions, strong opinions on your question.
Well, okay. The history of the debt ceiling was that it used to be whenever government would borrow money towards some specific end, and they'd have to go to the Treasury would have to go to Congress to say, could we borrow to build this canal, could we borrow for this purpose? And Congress said, instead of doing that, let's just set a debt ceiling, you can borrow up to that. And so it was designed to make it easier for the federal government to borrow, not harder. And, yeah, it's the sort of thing that, in industrialized countries, I think one other one has. It's sort of a weird anachronism. And there's some argument that might be unconstitutional, but I would defer to people who actually know something about the law.
Let me ask you one question, though. Again, the raising of the debt ceiling has been an annual August story with usually very little coverage year in, year out for well over a decade. What made it special this year? What were the conditions? Were they strictly political conditions, or were there economic conditions that made the decision to battle over the debt ceiling more important this year? Was it just the Tea Party, just the political climate?
I think it was that the majority party in both houses were not willing to pass it. I think that the Republicans in the House were not willing to pass a debt ceiling increase.
But there was also the issue that over the past decade or more, we have been having a deficit which has been growing a little more slowly than the economy has, and therefore it hasn't bumped up against this.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it hasn't bumped up against this issue. Students used to ask me, "How do we know when the deficit's too big, or the debt's too big?" And I didn't have a straight answer other than this one: the people will tell you. Hmm. The people will simply say, we've had enough, and that's kind of what happened with the Tea Party. And I think people were beginning to see that, yeah, you can borrow, and we always do need to borrow. We talked about this earlier. But there is a limit to what you can do. So I think that we just hit that limit.
But I'd say the people are represented by the bond market.
Yes.
Dale, do you want to tackle Larry's suggestion that maybe the president is deliberately trying to kill the economy?
I'd love to. I think it's hard to say that Obama is a socialist when he has alienated the progressive wing of his party. I think a lot of the cuts that were signed into this last bill will hurt the safety net that is the lifeblood of progressives and the far left. He has moved so far to the right that there is now talk, at least there was an editorial in the New York Times today, about a challenge from the left. They're trying to draft Hillary, someone who can stand up to the Republicans. So, because it appears to a lot of progressives in his party that he caves on everything the right throws at him. So I don't see how you can make the argument that he's a socialist and trying to take the country towards socialism.
And he certainly hasn't demonstrated that in military affairs either.
Certainly not.
Oh, no. And I don't actually care for him as president. I didn't vote for him. I won't vote for him the next time. But I wouldn't think for a second that he's trying to destroy the economy. He and I, we disagree fundamentally on almost everything. But he's a good man who just happens to completely disagree with me.
Right.
But I would never make such accusations.
And also to go back to something we shared on this program during the presidential race, again, because we obviously have covered Barack Obama when he was an Illinois state senator. I mean, the one thing about Barack Obama, not that he's that different from a lot of other politicians, he wants to be loved by everybody.
Absolutely.
He's trying. He is the conciliatory in chief, really. And that's getting him in trouble with the base because they thought that he was bringing change you can believe in.
Yes.
And some of them don't believe in that change anymore. Let's go to a car phone in Michigan, listening to us on our flagship station, WLS. And it's Rick. Go ahead.
How are you this evening? I have a couple questions. And my basic question is, if we want to grow the economy and if we want to put people back to work, we need to take the regulations and the burden off small businesses and even larger businesses that build the jobs, that can build more products, that can employ more people, that can generate more taxes, that can spend more money. We are too regulated in this country on too many different things. And the second point is, I have a friend of mine that works on an oil rig for a British Petroleum in the Gulf, and 3 miles down the Gulf was an American rig that shut down, and 3 miles from that is Venezuela. 2 miles to the left is China, and they're all drilling in the waters, but we can't drill, and and we're losing jobs, we're losing tax revenue, and our energy costs are going up because of some of these decisions.
All right, I'm going to let Dell tackle this one first. Again, we talked about your area of expertise being taxation in the first part of the show, but usually discussions of taxations are also, you know, followed by discussions of regulation. Again, let me put on a comparative basis, how do the regulations, the business regulations in the United States, how do they compare with the rest of the major industrial world?
Well, if you compare our regulations to China, we're a lot more strict. There is a lot more regulation here than in a place like China. But if you compare it to some of the European countries, it's somewhat of a mixed bag, but we may be a little bit more lax than those countries. But China is the big player, especially in things like oil drilling or Venezuela. Venezuela, the government captures most of the revenue, so the government is the player in the field. So regulation doesn't really apply because the government does whatever it wants
to do.
Well,
Rick's point is that we need more energy. We need more oil. We are, you know, we're hamstrung in drilling for oil because of the BP issue a crisis a couple of years ago, whereas other countries could care less. They're out there drilling away. So what's wrong? I mean, philosophically, are you a drill guy?
Well, for the most part, I think we should go out and find the oil where it is and get it out of the ground. But you have to do it safely because you don't want to drill somewhere and then have a spill. And then everybody doesn't say, well, I'm glad you passed that lax regulation. And the Exxon Valdez happens and everybody says, oh, it's your fault. You're the person. And no politician wants to be the person who said, I made regulations more lax so Exxon Valdez can happen.
But in the BP case, was it lax regulation that caused that?
Not my understanding. But
no.
That's not my memory of what caused it.
No.
Mark?
I'd say lax regulation, that if you privatize profit and socialize risk, you're going to get a lot of risk. And I think if we'd have had regulations saying if you're going to drill that far out, you need to have much better lockdown, we'd have had better lockdown.
Should there be more drilling now? I mean, because there was one error, significant error, do we just say we're not going to do that anymore?
No, we say you can drill, but you have to meet these conditions for shutting it down if there's a mistake.
And in your view, the caller is suggesting that there could be a direct link in
The caller's wrong. That we're not particularly more regulated now than we were at any point in the last 10 years. The problem with business and jobs right now is lack of demand.
That's correct.
If anything, we're less taxed now than we were at any point in the last 10 years because we have these holidays for payroll taxes.
And there's a lack of demand because there are fewer jobs and fewer people are spending fewer money.
Well, I think a collapse of the real estate sector, which a bit of regulation might have really helped to smooth that out.
In what way?
Keeping banks having some skin in the game for the loans they give, limiting who's able to borrow money, regulating what kind of loans are given. Also, maybe the plain vanilla mortgages so that, that you wouldn't trick people into sort of these teaser rates.
But that was government's fingerprints all over that,
absolutely,
right?
But I'm saying there's a lack of bad regulation or lack of regulation. I mean, you can't really quantify regulation. You can just say, is it good or is it bad?
Yeah, I agree that the government was behind part of it, but they weren't behind all of it. And I think that the Fed could have seen it coming sooner. Maybe Greenspan could have done something when he was the head of this and saying, look, I know what you're trying to do on Capitol Hill and you're trying to get more people into homes and so forth, but this can't continue to happen.
And Congress could have done a much better job when they were providing support or a bailout of the banks. They could have created some legislation that dictated how they were going to spend that money.
That's
not just buy up other banks and make their own bottom line look better. They're not giving capital out to people to start businesses.
No dividends, no bonuses.
Right.
Yeah.
But the problem is, and as a former investment banker, I can say this, no matter what Congress does, the investment bankers are going to figure out a way around it. I mean, it's just like tax policy. You can pass whatever well-intentioned policies you want, but people on the other side make more money by figuring out a way around it. And that's what would have happened with the banking rules. I mean, I was a banker who used to structure tax products to get out of paying taxes. And we made a lot of money for the bank. And there was no way
the government was going to. How do you feel about that?
Well,
are you proud of that?
I also went to the Department of Justice and prosecuted people who cheat their taxes. So I figure in the grand scheme of things, I'm even.
So you
remember tax.
So you knew what to look for.
Right.
Yeah, but tax avoidance is legal and tax evasion is illegal. There's nothing wrong with playing the rules as the rules have been set up.
But when you see a company that has a 6% tax rate, something about that just it doesn't pass the smell test.
Okay, and when you know, or at least in the last several months, it's become well known that GE paid no taxes last year, and most people are wondering, how come we didn't hear about that on NBC?
Maybe we should make some simpler taxes.
I can tell you how.
And what's Jeff Immelt's role in the Obama
administration? He's an advisor to the president. Back shortly from Chicago. From New London, Wisconsin, to New London, Connecticut, to New London, New Hampshire, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. We'll hear from New London, New Hampshire in a moment. Around the table this evening, we have Mark Witte is with us. He is the Director of Undergraduate Studies in the Department of Economics at Northwestern University, once worked for the Federal Reserve as a research associate, native of St. Louis, Missouri. Also joining us this evening is Mike Miller, a native of Pittsburgh and a University of Pittsburgh, right?
Yes,
undergraduate,
that's right.
University of Pittsburgh, Associate Professor of Economics at DePaul University. And Del Wright also joins us. He is from inside the Beltway initially, but now he is an Assistant Professor of Law at Valparaiso, Indiana. And as you heard him say in the last segment, once an investment banker, worked for Bank of America, and then went inside, worked for the Justice Department, and went after the bad guys.
Yes, I did.
So the balance was, did you get more of the money back than you made, you think? What do you think?
I don't think I got more of the money back, but I did put a few people in jail, so I felt pretty good.
Well, good.
As long as they deserved it.
Oh, they certainly deserved it.
I want to talk about something that you alluded to in the last segment, and something that we've heard for for the last several months, is in talking about the corporations and whether they pay their fair share. It's been stated over and over again that GE paid no taxes last year. And a lot of U.S. corporations are multinational corporations. They are no longer based in the United States. They set up shop in foreign lands. And you were saying that Ireland is one of the most popular places to go?
Yes, they have a
very low tax rate. Why is it popular, and who are the companies that go to Ireland that pay no U.S. taxes? Is that correct?
Yes. Let me take a step back. The way the system is structured is U.S. companies are only taxed on U.S. profits, or if they earn profits overseas, when they bring those profits back to the U.S. So what companies do is they move certain things that earn profits overseas. They keep the profits overseas, and they keep growing and growing profits. So if you're Google and you have $200 million in profits in Ireland, you say, well, I think I better open an Irish plant and hire Irish people, because if I take this money to the U.S., I have to pay 35% in tax. If I leave it in Ireland and invest in Ireland, I don't have to pay that tax. So that's why you see all these companies growing businesses and opening subsidiaries in foreign countries, because once they bring that money home, they have to pay the 35% tax. So what they do is they just leave enough business in the U.S. that they can keep their U.S. business and keep, their U.S. customers happy, but they move most of the gravamen of their business overseas and do most of their work overseas and keep the profits overseas. And that hurts the U.S. economy.
So I'm assuming that since this is a good deal, and you say Google is one,
yes.
Who are some of the other companies? Well,
Bausch & Lomb. There are a lot, almost all of the cruise lines are offshore. There are many U.S. companies that I'd say if you looked at the S&P 500, probably S&P 458 are overseas in some way or another.
So when in a political campaign, we will hear a candidate, usually it will be a Democratic candidate, that will talk about this issue. What would have to happen, and how realistic would it be for that tax law to be changed so that those corporations pay more in the United States? If not all, more in the United States. Is there a way realistically for that to happen?
There's a way realistically for it to happen, but I don't know if a Democrat could do it, because the Democrats would probably say, we want to raise taxes on corporations on their worldwide income. And what that might do is move countries all the way offshore. What I think a Republican can come in and say, we're going to lower corporate taxes to the worldwide average. And then you can say companies will have to say, well, why do we want to be in Ireland if we're going to pay the same tax in the U.S.? Then, and I think if you can get that money from Ireland back to the U.S. and maintain a low rate in the U.S., then companies will move back here, and then we can start to tackle our structural unemployment issues.
Do you agree with that, Mark?
Well, I mean, Ireland will be a tricky one because they essentially their whole game is having a lower tax rate than anybody else.
And then you get a race to the bottom.
Yeah.
Where you keep lowering your rate. But at some point, I think you can find a rate that will bring everybody back.
And when did this exodus begin? How long ago? Are we talking years ago, decades ago?
It started decades ago, but companies have gotten a lot more sophisticated in how they use it. And also a lot more of the profits being made now are being made in intellectual property, which are things that can move, like copyrights, like licenses. A license doesn't have to be made anywhere. A license can go a couple of keystrokes, and it's overseas. So therefore, the profits are overseas. So it's become a lot easier to do this in this information age.
So again, what is like from a political standpoint now? Okay, let's say that people have heard this, and again, in a presidential campaign or campaigns for the U.S. Senate, this is a frequent thing that you hear. Okay, it's all the money that's going overseas. Realistically, Mark, what can happen? How can that, in this political climate, how can that change? Given the fact that major corporations provide financial funding and support for both Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives.
Well, for most of the century, we've seen the share of tax revenues coming from corporations gradually declining and declining and declining. And it's been sort of offset in the government budget by raising payroll taxes. And so at some level, it looks just terrible. I mean, you think about who is the incidence of the tax of, you know, the corporate tax on. It's probably wealthier people. And who's the payroll tax on? It's, you know, working people. And so, that's a very unhappy thing to think about. But the corporate tax really is a very distortionary thing in the economy. Like, what's the point of a corporation? It's a way of organizing economic activity, generate profits, and send it to their owners. And the corporate tax gets in the way of that. It interferes with this very efficient sort of economic form, and it can, you know, causes corporations to try to find ways to get the money to their owners that are sneaky, that are sort of devious, that are, you know, the delay, the pay, mm-hmm. and that creates all these Enrons and things like that. So the corporate tax system really does cause a lot of harm in the economy.
Mike?
I'd be much happier if the corporations paid nothing, but then the household simply had to pay maybe a regular tax rate on dividends, because that would cover the revenue that would be lost.
But then then they wouldn't pay dividends. That's how you sneak around that.
But then they're going to get capital gains in the value of their stock. So then
the capital gains aren't taxed till you sell.
Well, that's...
So you'd have to tax on accrual or something. Yeah.
You could mark to market. You could say, look, if your stock was at $100 and it went to $200, you have to pay tax on that gain. Now, if you're going to couple that with eliminating the corporate tax, maybe it's a little bit more feasible. If you just say, we're going to do that, mm-hmm. no, it's not going to work.
Okay. And again, we should mention that this practice has grown under Republican and Democratic presidents.
Oh, absolutely.
It is an international monetary, a global issue that is not unique to the United States.
Yes.
People
yes.
are going where they can make the most money, and they're flying out of this
and
country.
And keep the most money.
Because
you mentioned a large percentage of the Standard & Poor's 400 or 500, you know, have already done this. Is there a major American company that you know of that still is based here that's not playing that game?
I can't say that I know of any that aren't. But I'm sure there may be some that it really depends on their product. If they have a product that is made in the U.S. and they don't have a lot of intellectual property and their shareholders are relatively okay with it, because mm-hmm. if you think about it, the shareholders are the people who care about this, because if the shareholders say, well, you can earn $1 in the U.S., pay 35 cents in tax, and we get 65, or you can earn $1 in Ireland, pay 5 cents in tax, and we get 95. And if you're the CEO who has to say, oh, I'm going to stay in the U.S.
So the shareholders, who are taxpayers, are making money because the corporations have gone offshore and reduced the cost and are hiring, in many cases, foreign labor to work for less money, and they're laughing all the way to the bank.
Yep. But the trick
and yet they may be irate.
Exactly.
Their taxes are going up. But or their services.
They're happy as shareholders. They're unhappy as taxpayers.
But the trick here is they aren't necessarily happy as shareholders because of the repatriation question. They'll be happy when they repatriate those foreign earnings, but until
Explain what that means.
No, the company won't, because the company's stock price will go up even if they don't repatriate the earnings, because the earnings are there.
What do you mean by that?
Repatriate. It means when you pay the tax in the U.S., when you bring the money back home.
Yes.
But the company's value is based on how much money they make. They don't care about when you bring it back home. So if you have $200 million in Ireland, you make $200 million of investments from Ireland. Company's happy. The shareholders are happy.
Let's go to New London, New Hampshire, as promised. And Steve is listening to us tonight on the Internet. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Bruce. The Red Sox game is on the radio. Just a few quick points. One is I fault the politicians, both the president and Congress, in probably not leveling with the American people. And that is, and I think one of the professors there, probably one from Northwestern, is that Professor Witte?
Yes.
Alluded to it, is that, you know, basically right now we have a lack of demand. Why we have a lack of demand is because we had a credit crisis that occurred, and the history of credit crisis and recoveries from credit crisis is a much longer recovery period of time than it is from a normal recession, you know, an inventory recession, for example. And so that, you know, we as a people expect things that aren't necessarily realistic. So, you know, and then we're all disappointed that things aren't better than they are, when it could be, it's just the way things are. You can't force the rebuilding of capital by individual. You can't rebalance their balance. You can't get their balance sheet up to date. It takes time to work off the excessive debt that people and the government have both had.
All right, I'm going to give our guests an opportunity to respond to that, but we do have to pause for a break right now. Back shortly from Chicago, 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Duhon. From Austin, Texas to Anchorage, Alaska, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8289. Your reaction to Steve, who called us listening on the Internet from New Hampshire. Everybody,
Steve was spot on, especially with regard to the business cycle, that financial cycles tend to be much worse. And that became all the more clear when the GDP figures were released and all the annual revisions, as they're called, and it showed that GDP fell not 4.1% during the recession, but 5.1%.
Mark, you agree with that?
Absolutely. His point about this being a financial crisis recession is a good one, that normally we'd have recessions because inflation is getting too high and the Fed would raise interest rates and slow the economy down, and then when the economy had slowed, lower interest rates, we get going again. This time it crashed without the interest rate spike, and so we can't undo it.
Del Wright from Valparaiso University is our tax expert. During the break, he made this statement about 50% of the people pay no income tax.
Well, yeah, but that statement is, you know, somewhat suspect in the fact that a lot of people pay payroll taxes. So they're paying into the system. They just aren't paying income taxes because of all the credits and the breaks and a lot of things in our system that say, well, if you don't earn enough, you don't have to pay income taxes, like the earned income tax credit, home mortgage deduction, all those things that reduce that rate.
If 50% of the people are not paying taxes for the reason
income taxes.
Paying income taxes for what you've just stated, and you've explained the way the corporations are getting around paying their taxes. Who's paying the income taxes?
The rich have always paid the income taxes.
They're the ones with the money.
Yeah. Effectively, I think, and I don't know the statistic off the top of my head, but roughly the top 5% of earners pay somewhere around 60 to 70% of the tax in income tax.
So going after them is unfair.
It depends on...
Granted, they have the ability to pay more, but singling them out if they're carrying most of the water is unfair.
They've always carried most of the water. The issue is, where do you draw the line? How much more do you take from the wealthy when this is the system we have?
Mark?
Well, and the run-up in the burden on the wealthiest really matches the run-up in their incomes, that there's been explosive growth at the top end of the income distribution, and that's brought their taxes up. I have a hard time, you know, crying for somebody who's, you know, become incredibly wealthy. It's like, oh, no, my taxes have gone up.
But there is a fairness question. What right is it of the
government
to take money?
35% marginal rate.
I can accept 35. Yeah. I don't like 39, but just because somebody's successful doesn't mean the government has the right to take it.
Sam in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, listening to us on WRNN. Go ahead.
The Obama administration passed 608 regulations in the month of July on business. And you have people like Steve Wynn saying, I'm not going to invest my money as long as Obama's in the White House because I don't trust him. You know, he scares me. Capital does not seem to like the guy. I mean, there are people that just don't want to invest. I mean, the administration is just passing so many regulations and businesses just don't want to put their money out there at risk.
Yeah, there's a lot of truth to that, but we got to keep in mind one thing, and that is that most of the new jobs that are created in the economy, the research is clear on this, come from new startups, from new businesses, and that's not where the regulation is going to be a problem. What it is whether or not there's people coming in the doors. I'm very sensitive to the idea about the role of government and regulation. I like it to be minimized and so forth. But there comes a time in business cycles once in a while where everything is demand-centered, and this is clearly a demand-centered problem.
Mark in Austin, Texas on KLBJ, the radio home of Kenny Raymeier. Go ahead.
Thank you. Someone mentioned the gross domestic product and the debt running up against it. The problem is the debt's rising relative to the economy overall, because the economy is not rising. And why isn't it rising? The simple fact of the matter is it's not rising because of offshoring that began to occur in earnest about 22 years ago, as I recall. So U.S. Gross domestic product and the consumer incomes and career opportunities in the tax base leave the country. So I guess my point is, let's have a conversation about introducing tariffs, notwithstanding all this intellectual property chat. But let's have a conversation about introducing tariffs to the equation and bringing the playing field a little bit more level, instead of calling things erroneously free trade agreements when they're not free trade agreements. They're designed to reward corporations for taking their companies offshore and taking advantage of poorer companies, or countries rather, produce goods and services to sell back to the likes of us, who borrow money on a daily basis just to survive and keep this existence going that we've got going. And we're broke. That's the one thing that nobody's really saying. We're broke. 45%, I think, of every tax dollar that's collected is paying interest. And to my understanding, paying interest doesn't really do anything for the gross domestic product. So, and the other thing about regulations guys were talking about, I'm glad that came up. I'm just sorry that Glass-Steagall never came up in the conversation. The real estate market, one of you guys had mentioned regulation or more responsible Congress. I think if we had a more responsible Congress, we wouldn't be in the kind of debt we are. And if we had a Federal Reserve that actually answered to the American people and the Congress instead of told them what to do, we would certainly be in a lot better shape. But the abolishment of Glass-Steagall is what created investment banks and commercial banks becoming
synonymous.
All right,
let's let everybody, very quickly, Mark, you want to respond to any element of his comment?
The U.S. is not broke. We're a very wealthy country. We just have fairly low tax rates. And offshoring is something that's been going on forever. And, you know, we had unemployment rates of, you know, 3.5-4%, and you know, the past 10 years, so a time of high offshoring. So I don't think that's related.
Also, keep in mind that what if your local donut maker decided, I have a way of making the same donut, that same quality, but I can do it cheaper for you? Would you be angry at them if they found a cheaper way to make the same good donut? And we have a situation here where people are finding other ways to make things, and some of times it involves shipping things overseas and bringing them back.
Ten seconds.
If people don't like buying things from overseas, don't go to Walmart. But Walmart stays in business because they hire overseas and they get the cheapest product to the American consumer.
And they buy them. And then they complain about why are the jobs going overseas. We are out of time. Our thanks this evening to Mark Witte and to Del Wright. Mark Witte is from Northwestern. Del Wright is from Valparaiso, Indiana. Mike Miller is from DePaul University. Again, gentlemen, another great discussion. We'll have you back for the next course in a few weeks. This program is a Genevieve production, produced in association with WLS Talk Radio in Chicago. Tom Vera Cruz and Sylvia Chavez and Dan Dorfman and Mark Glick made this program possible. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont when we will be live from Youngstown, Ohio. But right now, we say so long from Chicago.